50 episodes, millions of downloads, and listeners in almost 200 countries and territories, all in our first 365 days. This episode marks the one-year anniversary of Hodinkee Radio. And I have to say, this has been an extremely personal project for me. It's one of the bigger projects I've taken on during my time here at Hodinkee. And watching the enthusiasm build, not just in the audience, but also here internally over the last year, has been really amazing. One thing that podcasting lets us do that we can't do, no matter how hard we try in a magazine or on a website, is talk to you. You get an unfiltered look at who we are and where we're coming from and the stories we're trying to tell you. When our producer Gray and I first started talking about this show about a year and a half ago, we kept coming back to one idea: people. The watch world is so interesting, not just because of the objects, but because of the people who wear them, collect them, and love them. And from world-class athletes to famous musicians to watch industry legends and a whole lot more, we've had some pretty interesting conversations over these first 12 months. As the two of us sat down to put this anniversary episode together, I'll be honest, things got kind of emotional. It was really humbling to listen back to the dozens of hours of conversations we've had and hear all of those special moments again. Now, this isn't everything great, but it's what we could pack in, and we decided to focus on the earlier episodes since it's been a little while since you've heard those things. If you want to go back and listen to full episodes, we're going to have links to everything down in the show notes, and I highly recommend you do. I just want to say thank you again for all of the support you gave us in year one. We say this every episode, but we really couldn't make this show without you. And I couldn't be more excited for what's coming in year two. I'm your host, Stephen Pulverant, and this is Hodinkee Radio. So first up, we've got a clip that, when we decided to do this show, was a complete no-brainer to include here, and that's O'Malik talking about his philosophy on collecting, and that extends well beyond watches to things like experiences and the people he keeps close to him.
Yeah. And you know, I do get it that people want to be more knowledgeable and all those kind of things. I think you go on men's fashion forums and you see the same thing. It's like you don't really know what you're talking about. You just have to know what you wear, and your body will tell you whether that is great or not. Yeah. Your own eyes will tell you whether this watch is, you know, working for you or not, how you feel about it. I think a lot of it is learning to listen to yourself and not to the marketing and the brands and what everybody else says. It's pretty hard for most people, but that's where you need to end up. You know, and that's where you need to become, when you become a collector, that's how you should be thinking about not what you're going to sell in the future, but what you're going to wear every day. Mm-hmm. I think that's how I think about, you know, collecting watches. It's like, can I wear this every day for the rest of my life? And if the watch qualifies, yeah, I know you're pointing at your beautiful Patek and, you know, I probably can't do it. Like, I would not be able to wear it for the rest of my
life. I was kidding.
Yeah.
You know, I think of the same thing. And, like, the watches that I plan to keep for the rest of my life are typically new. They're usually below, you know, $5,000 to $6,000. And those are the watches that, like, I engrave on the back and will keep for the rest of my life, maybe give to a child if I were to have some someday. But, you know, things like this is just, like, it's kind of like it's fun. And it's a pursuit, and it's something that, like, I enjoy at this point in my life where my life revolves around watches. Will it always revolve around watches? Probably not. And so it's me, like, whenever I do anything, I go pretty hard for some period
really?
Of time.
Yeah, I didn't know that about you.
Indeed I do. And so this is me just, like, exploring watches to the end.
Yeah.
And then when I hit the end, I'll stop.
I agree with on that point. Like, you know, for me, the most expensive watch I've ever owned is, thanks to you, is a Moser,
mm-hmm.
right?
Okay.
And I'm, for my 50th birthday, I wanted to buy a watch, which I wanted to be, if, like, you know, Indians don't, like, Hindus don't get buried, but it was the proverbial watch I want to wear to my grave. Yeah. And that's how I wanted to, like, I love this watch. And basically, I started planning to buy this 2.5 years ago by using a really basic, you know, simple formula. I'm going to save $20 a day. for this watch. That's it.
Okay.
And like, and that was like my goal was to get to a point where I can buy this watch, not just because I can afford it. Like, it's, you know, that's not a problem for me, but I just wanted like this adventure in like saving and getting there and like. Yeah. And it was kind of fun.
There's
like,
a nice feeling to that,
there's a
right?
nice feeling to it. It's like, and you know, do I wear it every day? Probably not. I probably wore it once to a friend's wedding. That's it. And I'll probably wear it to another wedding. And it's not an everyday watch, but it reminds me of my 50 years on the planet. And I think it's got an emotional appeal. That's the first time I had a watch which just said, wow, that is you. Like, that is you in a watch. And I think I've always thought about that. And I think that is so important when it comes to anything, just watches, pens, you know, people who make you happy every day are the people you collect, people who are going to cause you misery. And that's how we should be thinking about all the objects too. Can they make you happy? Do they bring joy to your face every time you see them?
I travel a lot, I eat a lot of beef. It's an interesting life. You know?
And next up, we've got Gary Steingart talking about how the latest crop of faux vintage watches have him feeling like we've hit peak nostalgia.
And then, honestly, a lot of the current watches kind of leave me a little underwhelmed. This whole Fotina thing has been weighing on me philosophically.
Oh, do tell.
Well, there's a term that Vladimir Nabokov, author of Lolita and many books not about statutory rape. There's a Russian term he used, porchlist, which is a kind of vulgar imitation. Very hard. It doesn't really exist. No real direct translation. But it's a kind of vulgar imitation.
What's the word again?
Porchlist. P-O-S-H-L-O-S-T. I think it's how you would spell it in English. You know, and it could be of a sentimental nature. It could be kind of something unearned also, you know. Mm-hmm. And so when I see that kind of Fotina, and there's some of these watches are gorgeous. You know, the Longines, is it the military? There's some new watch that came out that has the dots on it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That has
yeah.
these, you know, computer aid design dots or right. whatever the heck. You
They're
know.
Like aging each dial
They're
separately.
Aging each dial, you know.
It's a whole thing.
I could just hear someone in Switzerland go, let's turn the nostalgia to 11, you know. but I think it's a gorgeous watch, you know, and if that watch was real, I mean, was an actual watch, then I'd be all over it.
I mean, we're in this funny situation now where the demand for nostalgia has outstripped the supply of actual sources of nostalgia.
Exactly. But when it comes to vintage
watches, it's a limited resource.
Nostalgia is all we reach peak nostalgia. But nostalgia also brings this kind of what to my mind is like the Blade Runner effect, which is remember that scene where Rachel, who's a replicant, talks to Deckard, the Harrison Ford character, who's the Blade Runner, and she says something like, "I'm real," you know, and he says, "I have memories," and Deckard says, "Those aren't memories; those are implants. That's Tyrell's niece's. Those are Tyrell's niece's memory. Right. Tyrell is the maker of the replicants, you know." And so often when I buy a watch like this one, which is gorgeous, and you know, I think, am I sort of being a replicant? Am I getting someone else's memories?
Right.
And I mean, to a certain extent, the answer is yes.
To a large extent, yeah. I think the answer is yes. Yeah. I mean, I still prefer being a replicant to Porchlist, Nabokov's vulgarity, right. But it's a question.
There's got to be a middle ground in
there's
there.
There's got to be a middle ground.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a memory I think back on often because it's like that was a moment.
There are a lot of wild stories from the early days of Hodinkee. And one of the craziest is this one that Ben told in our very first episode of Hodinkee Radio.
Helping Jay-Z launched this website in 2010 called Life and Times,
yeah,
which was his like lifestyle take, you know, fashion, cars, whatever. And my friend Rich, who was the CEO of Complex, who I'm still friends with, was like, oh, like, you know, you got to talk to this young guy, Ben. He'd be great to do your watch stuff. And so I started writing for Life and Times, and I got to meet, you know, Jay-Z a few times. And one time I helped him buy a few watches. And one time he wanted to buy, this is when he wanted to buy the watch for his Carnegie Hall show, which he was like, I want something that's like the least rapper watch ever. He like, you know, he was wearing a tuxedo. I was there in his apartment on Hudson Street when Tom Ford was there with all of his tuxes, which was
okay.
Fucking crazy.
Yeah.
And also like back then, I mean, even still now, like I was wearing like Sperry, you know, Docksiders. I'm not today, but I usually am. And like I came into his apartment and they're like, hey, take your shoes off. And so I take off my like literally like $49 Docksiders and beyond.
Beyonce has these, like, you know, Louboutin wedges, and then he's got, remember those spiky men's shoes that Louboutin had? And so I put my, like, Doc Sliders next to those two things. I'm like, what the fuck is going on? And so then I go in there, and his assistant's like, yo, chill while he does the suit fitting. I was like, of course. And it takes a while, like, you know, whatever. And I'm looking at my watch, and I'm just like, oh, fuck, I've got a consumer journalism class right now. Like, I'm going to be late to class. And I was like, which is more absurd, like telling Jay-Z I got to go because I got to get to class, or telling my professor that I was late because I was at Jay-Z's house? So I ended up staying, of course. And I helped him buy that rose gold Reverso, which he wears all the time now. And we had it engraved with Carnegie Hall and his initials, SEC, on the back.
Super cool.
But those were some surreal times because I had no money to my name at all. I was really hustling. It was just me at Hodinkee back then. And we were publishing every day while I was in full-time journalism school and trying to pay my rent, you know?
Your first Basel Fair. Going there with a brand.
Hodinkee's not the only company with some crazy stories in its past. Here's Jean-Claude Beaver at age 10 talking about some of the things he did in the early days of Blancpain.
Nobody, when you are a startup, we were a startup because we bought the brand for $22,000, but the brand was not existing. It was just the name. The brand had gone out of business 20 years before. We didn't have money. That's it. And when you have no money, we went to Basel Fair with a camping bus. And we were sleeping in the camping bus. It was a Volkswagen Westfalia. I bought one 10 years ago. And I said to my wife, now we're going with camping bus to Greece. She said, what? So you see, I've never forgotten this incredible period of the camping bus. And so we were sleeping in the camping bus behind the Basel Fair near the railway station. And in the morning, we had to shave and to clean. So we went to the railway station, putting one Swiss franc and shower for 3 minutes. And then we went with a nice tie, went to Basel Fair, and we said, where do you stay? We said, well, we stay in the Hilton. but we had to catch attention. And in order to catch attention, because we had no collection, Blancpain was one watch. It was a moon phase watch, one watch. And it existed in two versions, 33 millimeter and 33.3 millimeter diameter. And we had one version in steel and one steel and gold. That's it, only two. If you have two watches and you have a boost, and in those days in the Basel Fair, everybody was showing watches. So brands had 30, 40 watches in their different showcases. As we had only two watches to show, and you know, if you show two, it makes very poor. We decided we show none. So we had the boost with a wall, no showcase. And everybody came and looked, what's that? And it was written, instead of Hodinkee, it was written Blancpain. And people said, but Blancpain, Blancpain, we never heard about it. Or some people said, I remember 30 years ago. But what are they doing? So we had to catch attention. Because we showed no watches, everybody spoke about us. And everybody said, have you seen the watch? So that was our strategy. We had another, you know, when you are startup, you must think startup. This is why big groups, they can never develop a startup in theory, because big groups, they don't think startup. They think consolidated and technocracy. So there was another element in the beginning. We had customers, and customers were a little bit reluctant. And we had a strategy, and it worked very well in Zermatt. Zermatt is a ski resort, because we were sending people to buy our watches in the shop. And in Zermatt, there's a shop called Schindler, and Schindler, he was reluctant. I was making a running marathon with him, but even I was running a marathon, he said, I don't want your watch. Okay. So finally, he bought two, one and one. I mean, it was $2,000 to buy. But in the mountains, people are very careful, and $2,000 is a lot of money in the mountains. They, you know, they think really, that's why they are so rich at the end. you find more rich people up in the mountains than in the cities. So Schindler bought two. I have sent friends. I said, okay, you go to Zermatt and you buy me a watch. So I gave the money, and my friend went up and bought the watch. He spent a nice day in Zermatt. It was nice. He skied and he bought a watch. And then the sister of my wife, I said to her the same, you buy a watch. So they went for the weekend, they bought a watch. On Monday morning, Schindler calls me, God damn, I sold the two watches. I'm gonna buy five. And so that's how we started, you know? And we did this with many other people. So.
One more on this phase, and it'll be the last for me in this round, and we'll throw it open. So think about your questions. But you also managed somehow to open the great Tiffany & Company here in New York City. How'd you do that?
Yes, I played the same game, more or less. I made an appointment with Mr. Tiffany Kowalski. He was the boss of buying. He was purchasing department. And I got in touch with him by phone. And I said, listen, I am in Switzerland. I'm interested to see you, to sell you my brand. He said, oh, blah, 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 I'm not so much interested. Don't lose time with me. I said, no, we will not lose time. Probably you have a little sandwich for lunch, and we can eat the sandwich together. And while eating, we can speak. And if after 20 minutes I have told you nothing interesting, at least you haven't lost time, because you have to eat your sandwich anyhow. And he agreed. So he said yes, and I said, I come tomorrow. He said, I'll come. I say, I take the Concorde. But I was already in New York.
So, everybody remembers the Concorde, right?
No,
3.5 hours, hours to New York.
And in reality, I flew with a very cheap ticket, which was called standby. You had to wait till they call you and say, hey, we have three tickets. And you were running, buying one for 180 Swiss francs. So this was the type of tricks we did. So there was nothing dangerous. It is romantic what we did. It was, you know, harmless. But these little tricks, people that go to Harvard Business School, they don't learn them. This is why I go every That is why I go every year to Harvard, and I tell the boys and girls that are there what we did. Because technocracy I cannot teach, but startup development I can teach.
Here, but it's good to get you both in the studio.
Absolutely busy weekend. It's a good weekend.
So directly after Jean-Claude's talk at H10, Jack, Aldous Hodge, and I hopped in a cab, went to the studio, and decided to record an episode while we were still basking in the afterglow. Talking about H10,
yes.
By the way, we're recording on Saturday night, fresh off almost an hour and a half of pure, unadulterated Jean-Claude Beaver.
He's an intense individual.
He is an intense and wonderful individual.
Yeah,
I brought some folks, some friends, not to see my own panels, but to see Jean-Claude Beaver. I said, you know, you not being watch people or in the industry, you'll never get another chance to hear this guy. And you just have to see this human being for an hour.
Don't lie. You brought him to see you.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So I brought them to see me. I'm the appetizer for...
Jean-Claude goes on at 4. Be there at 9 o'clock in the morning. Don't worry. Don't ask
all
questions.
Right,
why?
Right.
Just be there.
All right. Had you ever seen him on before?
No. I mean, interviews online, but I'd never seen him in person. Never really speak with such passion and ferocity. But I can kind of tell. I'm like, oh, his pictures make sense now, because he always seems like a sort of a jovial, kind of happy person in his pictures. But he's kind of got a spark about life.
Yeah.
And, you know, giving us some of his past and his some of his experience and what how he had to think in order to get to where he's at, it makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, he had to be as sly and beguiling and innovative and just, you know, humorous as well, I think.
And, you know, I mean, one of my favorite things about his, you know, early days when he was trying to find distribution in the U.S., you know, he's very proud of having been a one-man dirty tricks department.
Yeah.
Great pride.
Speaking here, I think you're talking about the fact that he called Tiffany and said, I'd love to take a meeting. I'll hop on the Concorde. I'll be there tomorrow. And they were like, oh, okay, you're really dedicated. He was already in New York. He was calling from a payphone. The street. But so that they would think he was this big operation. But
That's business, man.
It worked.
So many people we see floating at the top right now have done things like that, and that's what we call innovation.
Yeah. Actually, I mean, honestly, I think it would be a much more interesting watch industry if there were a few more people floating at the top who'd done stuff like that. I mean, a lot of the time nowadays, it's guys who came up through finance school, and you know, they could be working in pharma or selling, you know, candy bars. You know,
there's a different passion that's applied to the future of a company when your beginnings have to be creative.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, he's a watch guy. Like, I mean, we've featured him on Talking Watches and other things, but he's a watch guy. He loves watches. Whereas a lot of these executives we interview all the time, they don't, like you said, they don't care. They could be selling drugs or chocolate or, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter.
You got to love it, man. If you're in the business of watches, watch selling, watch making, whatever, if you want to see a real future out of it, I think you have to love it. It's an essential element, because otherwise you're not going to be a part of the growth. You're not going to push the growth. You're just going to sit there and sell whatever, you know, get shoveled out. But, man, you got to love it enough to know this is how I want to see it evolve, and this is how I want to make it better. You know, it's a part of it.
I agree with you, and I think over the long term, that's the only way to go. But it's also possible to kind of sell mass-produced, mass luxury goods a little bit cynically, and you know, still make money for the shareholders from one year to the next. You know.
Yeah. So I look at it two different ways, because there is that, which I definitely agree with you in that you can build financial success, but I think in the market of watchmaking, there's two different. There is the financial success, which kind of envelops the commercial success of a brand, but then there's also horological success.
Right.
You know, me, I'm a watch designer, very, very novice horologist, you know, and when I study, I'm looking towards what can be contributed, what can I do that can contribute something to the world of horology.
Yeah.
So if I make one great watch and only sell one watch, I've still succeeded.
I just have to say, for context, by the way, I think you're short selling yourself a little bit.
Yeah, I would agree with Jack on that one.
this is literally the only person who came into the office and asked me if I'd read Saunier.
That stands out to me. We were talking ahead of Hodinkee 10.
Treatise on Horology. It's a classic.
Yeah,
classic.
Claudia Saunier. Yeah, still dipping through that.
Yep.
Of course, George Daniel's book, you know, watchmaking. That's the basically the Bible. George Daniels has a book, sort of a thesis, really on escapements, and then he has another one on Breguet.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting things about the Verge escapement in that book, but man, that's how I taught myself, because I can't afford the time to been 2-3 years at WoStep. I would love to, but you know, as also an entertainer, you know, I'm doing a TV show, and they're like, "Look, bro, you got 6-7 months. You got to knock this down. You can't go nowhere."
It's a little hard to shoot from the Swiss Jura. It's not too much TV production happening there.
I got catching up to do, and I got a lot to prove, man. Let people not take this seriously.
Sit down and have a nice chat. And who can forget that time that we recorded with Matt Horanek and he showed up to the studio with a bottle of pre-mixed Negronis?
There's four people in studio.
Yeah.
And they're four Negronis, which I'm very proud to have supplied today.
Global ambassador to the entire drink.
Yes. Yeah. I hope someday I'll be financially recognized for that. But
it's a position of stewardship, I think, mostly.
I'm just happy to, you know, be consuming them.
These are special Negronis too, right?
Yeah. So I thought you know, since it's a Friday afternoon. Do people know this is a Friday afternoon?
Yeah, I mean, they do now.
They do now. So I thought, what a perfect opportunity to kind of pre-bottle some Negroni so I didn't have to, like, travel all from Brooklyn to here with, like, all the fixing. So I this morning, before the coffee, I pre-bottled some Negroni to 1:1:1 proportions, as every good Negroni lover knows. And I used a very special vermouth, which is this Punta Mess vermouth that was bottled in the 1960s. I bought a case of this vintage vermouth. And the thing about vermouths and bitters and high spirit percentage alcohols, they survive all conditions. So normally if you find them, even open, they're usually still good. So I bought a case of this stuff, and it's spectacular. It's like other level because it was made in a time when people's palates were different, the tastes were different. So it's much more herbaceous and bitter. There's less sugar in it. And as it ages, it just becomes a richer version of itself. So I love Negronis. Like if I can get my hands, and I have a few bottles, and I actually have a shipment of coming from Italy this week, of vintage Campari, which again, the same flavor profiles, right? More bitter, less sweet, different recipe. Pre-1990 was a different recipe. I make these Negroni Vecchio, which is the old Negroni. So this is Mezza Vecchio, because it's only the vermouth that was old. Vintage, we'll call it vintage. But it's a much richer flavored thing, if you've noticed.
It's a pretty damn good way to spend a Friday
afternoon.
It's
really delicious, and it's less sweet than I expected.
It's less sweet.
Which I appreciate quite a bit.
And there's some Monkey 47 gin in there. I like classic London dries. I love the flavor profiles of this gin. And but I would say in general, you get the proportions right, you could pretty much, you could use what's available. But that's what was available to me.
Another time zone. I thought it was cool, so he wore that too.
Matt Jacobson's a collector I've known for a long time, and his one-in, one-out policy has become something of watch community legend. I don't think you'll get there. You do have a kind of, artificial restraint on your collection, right?
Yeah, no, I listen, and this is like, I'm picking up a watch from you. We'll talk about it later. I'm picking up a watch that I bought from you guys today, completely unplanned, which kind of puts me in a pickle because now I have to get rid of something. So, because I have a very strict rule about one-in, one-out on pretty much everything. So whether it's a T-shirt or a pair of shoes or a car or a bicycle or a watch, surfboard, like that, I have a very limited thing. And so I store, you guys have these beautiful cases. I store my watches in these little Pelican cases with foam inserts for watches. And they have six slots in each. I have two of those. So I have room for 12 watches. And that's it. And the thing that's great about that is, 12 watches for a civilian, is too many watches.
Yeah.
But for a collector, I'm not really even in the game. But for me, it's about having really good examples, either watches that really matter to me that I care about, or watches that are like the best examples of what they are. And by limiting the number of watches I buy, I'm able to kind of get the best versions of those. So instead of just having a lot, I try to go for the best versions of the ones I can get.
Yeah, I had read you quoted saying something similar about Japanese denim. Like, you could have one really great pair of jeans or a bunch that are just kind of okay, and you'd rather focus on having the one that you genuinely appreciate.
And that's a very Japanese way of kind of buying and collecting. Absolutely. It's like, you don't need a lot of stuff, right? And I've been really good about purging a lot of stuff out of my life that, are unnecessary. I don't want watches I don't wear. I don't want cars I can't drive. I don't want a museum.
Right.
Right. When I sell stuff, I don't look back. I think I told you when you guys were in LA, I had a 18 karat Paul Newman, beautiful black dial, just insane watch. I owned it for a long time. I paid, very little money for it at the time because they weren't worth a lot of money. And, I was so like, I don't think about it. I don't miss it because it was getting to be that kind of a watch that you couldn't wear. I'll tell you a funny story with that watch. When I owned it, I was wearing it one day and I looked down and one of the pushers was missing.
And that's like a nightmare.
Yeah. And so I went like bananas.
I think James just started sweating.
Yeah. I'm very uncomfortable.
So I went bananas. Tore up. Like, I was at a restaurant. I was in the parking lot. I was on my hands and knees in the restaurant. I was looking in the parking lot. I took the seats out of my car. I looked everywhere for that pusher. Couldn't find it. Then I was going to find, then I had a stainless steel version. I was going to take the pusher off. I was going to have it 3D printed, you know, in gold and like machined. You know, I went through this whole thing. Then I said, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to put the watch away. I'm not even going to think about it. You know, I've owned this watch probably for 10 years already.
Right.
I've probably worn it 5 times. Right. So like, this is just bringing me nothing, but like, I'm thinking, I'm wasting too much time and too many calories on figuring out this pusher. So 6 months later, the plumber was at my house and he was like doing something. And like, you know, we're like pretty meticulous. It wasn't like there's like a lot of stuff laying around, and he found the goddamn pusher, you know, like under the sink, you know, just there. He goes, do you want this? And I couldn't believe it. So it was fantastic. So then the pusher, so then it reunited with the watch. And I said, okay, now, like, because I realized, like, that was, like, my 3D printing scheme wasn't going to really work. And no one had an 18-karat gold pusher for it. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, okay, now it's, like, this is, like, a good, like, this is a good message. Like, this is time for this piece to move on.
And it kind of highlights the whole idea that there are scenarios, if you're not in control of, you know, whether you pick a number like 12 watches or whatever, but there's scenarios where what you buy and the things you own end up owning you and like not making you happy.
It was too much stress.
For sure.
Right? It was too much stress. I remember I was wearing that watch one day and a guy said, he goes, like, good for you for wearing that watch. And I thought to myself, well, that's weird. He's like, you know, why wouldn't you wear it? And I realized, oh my God, there's people who don't wear this stuff.
You know, so. If you're stressed out about a watch, that's probably a bad sign. That's probably a sign that you should be doing it like a little bit differently.
These things, I mean, this is a whole, I was thinking about coming to talk to you today, and it's all about it being fun. If it isn't fun and you don't enjoy it, we don't need any of this stuff.
No.
Right? But it's fun.
And somebody will come to you with a microphone. Building off the theme of one in, one out, we thought it'd be good to include this clip of Alton Brown talking about how to best manage your kitchen equipment.
You are famous as a gear nut for disliking things that only do one job.
Correct.
What do you think are the most useful and the most useless things that somebody can have in their kitchen?
Well, first I want to say unitaskers versus multitaskers. I waged a war on unitaskers, but then I relented a little because I realized that perhaps that was only my lack of imagination with that particular tool. Okay. Because other people have come and said, well, I use this for this. And I'm like, oh, yeah, all right, I was wrong. I don't like tools that only do one job, but I have found that if people use their imaginations, actually tools do all kinds of jobs. It just depends on the mind. You know, for me, I am constantly surprised by how often I reach for a panini press.
Okay,
totally. I have never made a panini in a panini press. I will do that between two hot cast iron pans, but I will do a lot of other things in a panini press. I make the best Cornish hens in the world in a panini press. I cook things in there all the time, but I don't...
You spatchcock it and put it in a panini press?
You said spatchcock.
I did say spatchcock, yeah. I told you, I watched the show.
Yes, I spatchcock it and throw it in there, and then I put a bunch of weights on it and squeeze the ever-living crap out of it, but I cook all kinds of things in there. So I think that any tool that puts your imagination into play, and you start thinking, I could use this to do this, is a good thing. It could be a steamer basket. It could be anything, any tool that you can buy. So what's a unitasker really? I think a unitasker is defined by the person. If you buy a tool that only does one thing, you better be using it all the frickin' time. It's like, because somebody's like, okay, I bought a robotic, and this actually exists, a robotic donut fryer.
Oh, wow.
Now, that doesn't do a whole lot of things, but it does one thing really well. And I knew a person in Seattle who had bought this old vintage. They used to set them up in storefronts, and it was a thing that would take the dough and it would squirt it, and it was like an assembly line robot for donuts.
Yep.
It was like, it's a unitasker, so I'm going to have to get rid of it. And I said, let's cook some calamari in that bad boy. And then we made robotic donut line calamari. We had to throw out the oil because it tasted kind of greasy. But but the point is that, you know, in the end, the best thing that kitchen tools can do for us is to get us to play. You know, the kitchen's a laboratory and a playroom at the same time. So the things that are in it are toys, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right? So we're making food, but we're also expanding our minds. We're expanding our imagination. So whatever you can pull off, do it.
I'm really curious, did you have an experience like that where you just...
Next up, Stephanie Bednarik talks about some early memories of watch shopping.
To be honest, when I got engaged and I got a really nice diamond ring from my fiance, I thought it was not really fair that I got diamonds and he got nothing.
And bravo for thinking that.
Yeah, and so I really wanted to get him a watch, and that's what started this whole research spiral. But as I got to learn about movements... and the history of watches and some really iconic watches, I instantly wanted a Speedmaster, right? I work in the space industry.
Oh, yeah.
The Speedmaster is the watch to have. That was great. And so I went and tried one on, and it was giant on me. And it just doesn't fit. I tried it with a strap. I tried it on a bracelet. And my thought at the time was, I'm going to buy one watch. This is the watch I'm going to wear every day.
Right.
And it's too big on me. And I was so disappointed. And I was trying to look at, are there other space watches that might be of interest? And there really weren't. They were trying to get me into some of the ladies' models of Speedmasters. I was like, no, they have diamonds and they're
right.
They're all sparkly. No, I really want the
plus.
The
you know, if you're just from an engineering standpoint, from an engineering purism standpoint, like if you are in the air, you're working in the aerospace industry, you're a rocketry geek, you're a space exploration geek. You don't want like anything other than the watch that, you know, was and still is, you know, currently certified for manned spaceflight. You want the Moonwatch.
I want the Moonwatch. Yeah. No, I wanted the Moonwatch.
The hell with all that other stuff.
Yeah, I couldn't get the Moonwatch. You know, that was a big, huge purchase for me to want to be able to do that. And I couldn't do it. So I was really disappointed. Then I went on the other side of the spectrum and decided to research women's watches. What's the most classic women's watch that you could get within a reasonable budget? Mm-hmm. And I settled on the Cartier Tank, thinking that,
great choice.
You know, if Jackie O can wear it, maybe I can wear it too. That would be fine. Yeah. And it's, and I love it. I still wear it all the time. It's a great watch. But one time when I was trying on a Speedmaster and a Tourneau store in the DC area, I ran into an astronaut who I work with on a regular basis.
Oh, no,
he spent some time on the International Space Station, and we just got to talking about watches. And I was like, you know, what are you looking at? What's your next watch? Right? You can always bond with somebody over talking about that. And he's like, oh no, I'm just picking up my watch. I'm like, what watch are you picking up? Oh, my Speedmaster. It's like, you mean a Speedmaster or your Speedmaster you flew with? And he's like, the Speedmaster I flew with. And I was like, these guys have no idea that watch
they
has been
no
on space station. And he let me look at it and try it
so
on.
So are most of the astronauts now flying with watches that they own, or are they government issued?
It's actually a really good question. I think they mostly, I don't know if they're issued or if it's what they fly with, but I think they fly with X-33 now. Mm-hmm. I think that's the one that I've seen some of the astronauts that I occasionally get to interact with. That seems to be what they're wearing.
Okay.
I would love to know what women astronauts have worn. That would be really interesting.
Is it not the same watch?
It probably is. But like, what did Sally Ride wear? What did like the first Russian in space, Valentina Tereshkova, what watch was she wearing? That would be fascinating.
Oh man, this is years later.
I'm pretty lucky that I get to listen to Joe Thompson tell stories on a regular basis. But one of my favorites is this one he tells of a trip to Tokyo.
Probably the early to mid 2000s. Okay. By now, I've gone to Japan. I mean, I stay on the Japan story. I go out there, and Tsutomu Mitome, who wants to be called Tom, he wanted to be called Tom because there's a Tom in his first name, says to me, listen, and they knew I love sushi. Now, sushi in Japan, I mean, you know, it's kind of a quick lunch food. I mean, in many ways, I mean, it's also a very, very elegant thing. And he says to me, listen, and he was a gourmet himself, and loved Japanese cuisine, and would always give me tests. And this is for another time. I mean, I've eaten some amazing things as a result of meals with Mitome. So he says to me, we have meetings in the morning, Mr. Tom Mitome and I. He's the CEO. And he says, listen, for lunch, we're going to go to a little sushi restaurant. He says, it's very good. I mean, this is so Japanese. I mean, he would not say to me, this is the greatest sushi restaurant in the world. He doesn't tell me that. And he says, but don't be put off by the venue. It's in the subway station at the Ginza. And Seigo offices were close to the Ginza, so we walk over to the Ginza, and then we go down, And then there's a tiny little sushi restaurant, you know, and we go in and we're talking shop. I mean, I love Motomi. It was great to talk to Motomi. We're talking wine. We sit down, the two of us are there, and there's chefs behind the counter, and there's an older gentleman there. And I'm not paying any attention to that because I'm with Motomi. And all of a sudden, I can see that the chef is kind of a stern guy. Anyway, I'm not paying a lot of attention to him. And then all of a sudden, I hear this kind of a grumbling. He's talking to Motomi. You know, it's kind of a little bit, and it seems to me
your
to be
Japanese is immaculate.
Thank you. Seems to me to be quite, I don't know, like maybe something's wrong. So, Motomi, hi. And then, okay, now, as you know, in a fine sushi restaurant, there are pauses in between. And, you know, then the meal's prepared, the piece is prepared, and you put one or two on the palm. And so we're talking, and just as the next one comes, Motomi says to me, "Listen, Joe," he says, "listen, by the way, let me give you a tip about eating sushi." He says, "Here's how we do it over here." He says, "When you take it, and we just tip it with our chopstick, we just tip it on its side, so the fish is on the side to your left, and then you take it with your chopstick, and you just take the fish, and you dip it just ever so slightly into the soy sauce. Not too much. So, you know, so try that. See if you like that." And I'm like, "Oh, okay. Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Tom. I'll do that."
So thanks, Tom. Tom. Yeah.
Thank you.
No big deal.
So I do that. So we leave. I'm not a complete idiot. We leave. We walk out. I say to him, "Tom, what happened with the sushi chef in there?" And I said, "He was upset with me, wasn't he?" And he looks at me and I said, come on. He didn't want to tell me. I said, "Come on, come on, tell me. What did he say?" And then he smiled and he said, he looked at me and he said to me, "If that gaijin dips his rice into the soy sauce one more time, I'm tossing the two of you out of here." So, and then the end of the story is that, yeah, whenever it comes out, I mean, maybe 10 years ago, whatever it is, a documentary comes out. It's called Jiro Dreams of Sushi. And it's about this sushi restaurant in the subway at the Ginza and how this is the greatest sushi chef that ever lived. And, you know, I see it. I mean, holy crap. That's Jiro. I know Jiro. You know, I'm the barbarian that infuriated Jiro, and because I came in there and absolutely just trashed his joint.
It's amazing.
Oh man! So it's just this was sort of the
Joe Thompson's like Forrest Gump moment where he just touches history ever so slightly.
Exactly.
Oh my god!
I kind of hope that there's like a picture of you, Joe, behind the counter at the restaurant. No. That's just like no gaijin behind the counter.
It's embarrassing. Yeah, maybe after I left, it was. I mean, the whole thing's embarrassing to me. But it just. I mean, can you believe it? I mean, that's unbelievable.
Unreal.
You know, just damn near thrown out of Jiro's. Oh my god.
Can I just stay home and watch Netflix?
I've never had a hangover, let's just put it that way. Yeah, like it's always...
Ted Gashu lives that bucket list lifestyle on Instagram, but here's one story that didn't make it to his feed.
I'm very, very lucky.
So let's get specific here. Tell me about the Mila Milia.
The Mila Milia, in its current form, is a it's more of a rally than a race, but the original race was one of the ballsiest, craziest, most insane things you could ever possibly do. So you had guys like Sterling Moss, legendary racing drivers, driving at top speed on dirt roads through Italy, doing 1,000 miles in under 24 hours. And which today is not that much of an accomplishment, like you can kind of do it, but like these guys were going like 130 on bicycle tires with boat engines strapped. You know, like the cars that they were driving were just totally
totally mental. And I was very lucky to do it for the first time, and I've been a few times now, in a 1938 BMW 328, bodied by Touring Superleggera.
1938. I mean, think about how old that car is.
It's a $25 million car from the BMW Museum.
And they let you behind the wheel.
Yes. And unfortunately, we had a slight mishap.
Slight mishap?
Well, we came around the roundabout after some rain, and the car fishtailed. I corrected, but not perfectly. And we clipped a guardrail.
How'd that feel?
Expensive for them. Deeply, deeply expensive. I have not been invited back by them. So. But which is not to say I don't have a great relationship with BMW. Ben Voss runs their vintage department over there, and he's just an incredibly lovely guy. So we still hang out, but that was a tough one. Actually, I was crying genuinely because I was so passionately in love with this car. And once it happened, I stopped the car, and my co-driver was Dr. Marcus Schramm, who is the director of strategy for all BMW. So he's like the number two or three guy there, and he was like, "You fucked up."
When that guy looks at you and says you
he's
fucked up,
6'7" chain smoker who runs ultra marathons, incredible guy. But then the mechanics walked up and they're like, "Das ist kein Problem, schneller. This is a race. Like you have to go." Like, and I was just like, "Okay." I had a really crazy experience with that.
Me feel terrible. These guys are so nice.
I gotta ask. Rules are a popular thing with watch collectors, but here Matt Scannell tells us about his rules and how he's always breaking them anyway.
Okay, so no dress watches, because why? This is gonna offend people who are much more knowledgeable.
This is great.
I am, and I'm okay with it. Like no dress watches, no gold, no rose gold. I don't care, James. I don't care. I don't care. No date windows, no stick hands.
So no Rainbow Daytona at all.
Never a rainbow. No, or actually Rainbow Daytona gets a pass on every level.
Oh.
Yeah. If I had a Rainbow Daytona, I'd probably...
Had to bring it up.
I'd want two, and I'd want to do it Morgan King style. No stick hands, no chronographs, no dates if possible, definitely no days. And I unfortunately break these rules all the time. So yesterday I was wearing a Seiko, I'm going to get the reference wrong, but a Seiko 6109, the blue, 6105 is, 6105, this doesn't matter, but I want to say that the 6105 is a dive watch, because I just bought a 6105-8000, which is the transition model before the sort of Apocalypse Now watch that everyone knows with that slightly... This is a visual motion that I'm making to everyone in podcast land, but it's sort of an asymmetrical case. This one is a very symmetrical case. Regardless, the watch I was wearing yesterday is the blue version of the Pogue, essentially, right. And it's got stick hands, it's a chronograph, and it's got a day of the week and the date.
Yeah.
So all rules broken.
Sweet.
Yeah. If it only were gold and was on a leather strap, that's another rule, no leather straps. Sorry, guys. I mean, I'm on the wrong podcast.
Wow.
Sick burn.
No, I like NATOs. I like cloth, but I don't own a leather strap, and I don't own anything that's brown. And I really don't have, I really honestly don't have much rationale for any of this. But you asked me what my rules were.
That's fair.
And I'm going to answer them.
Great.
I get it.
Do you?
I don't like wearing leather straps that much either, and I don't like brown. And I make rules, and then I break them.
A lot of these people who you see is like Brandon. And here, James Marsden shares with us why he's the kind of guy who, when he gets interested in something, can't help but go deep. But you're like, you're a real watch guy.
I'm a nerd.
Yeah.
I love them. I love it. But I'm that way with a lot of things in my life. You know, I'm a technician. I like the details that go into special things, that why this car is special, this guitar, this piece of art, you know. This espresso maker, like what, you know, like whatever it is.
Nerds tend to be nerds about lots of things. Like I don't know many people who are like really into watches, but like don't care at all about cars or cameras or something, you know?
Right, right. Well, there's a lot of people out there that you see that wearing a, you know, $300,000 watch, and they bought it because it's a $300,000 watch. They don't know much about it or why it's special. They're just like, oh, this is, you know, this is that name on there, and I'm wearing it, and it's expensive. And that kind of drives me crazy because, like, I, you know, I have a nice little relatively modest collection, and some of them are like, you know, $50 Seiko 5s. You know, like,
it's a cool thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is a $50 automatic movement, you know, watch that will continue to run as long as it's moving. And so I am fascinated with the details about why something is special and the sort of the craftsmanship that goes into all of it. So yes, I think the expectations, I don't know, when I started talking shop with all my friends and family over there at IWC, they were like, whoa, how do you
you actually know that?
And I'm like, how do we make a, you know, 40 millimeter, you know, perpetual calendar, split second perpetual calendar, and they're like, whoa.
Slow down, yeah. This is not what we're paying you for.
Right. How do you know this, first of all? So I tend to, when I get into something, I immerse myself in the science of it all, because that's, I just can't get enough information about it.
Yeah.
And watches became one of those things for me.
So when did you first get into watches? Was it before you started working with IWC?
Yeah. And I wasn't diehard before that, but they definitely sort of shepherded me into, you know, the world of fine watchmaking, you know.
Yeah.
Before that was, you know, I had when I was in high school, it was like one of those Casio, was it F91s or whatever? They're just like basic Casio, you know. And I had a, Seiko because my uncle had he said, oh, you want to wear a Seiko because it's Okies spelled backwards.
if you're from
Oklahoma, then you're
that's cool.
You're an Okie. So like, oh, that's cool. I'll wear a Seiko because it's Okies spelled backwards.
That's cool.
My first very nice watch was given to me in 2001, by David E. Kelly as a wrap gift for the season of Ally McBeal.
Cool.
And it was an IWC, and it was a Portofino. And I was like, I've never been given that nice of a gift as a wrap gift. And it was like, whoa, that's just cool. Well, I'm going to learn about this thing. What is it? Why is this like special? And so it was just sort of happenstance that was like the first real nice watch I got. And then my father gave me a Rolex Submariner. And I don't even remember what year it was. I think it was from the 80s. And it kills me because we were shooting X-Men 2 in Alberta, Canada, in some crappy little hotel. We were staying out in the middle of nowhere in this like little, you know, motel. And I left it on the nightstand. Oof. And the housekeeper made some money.
Oof, that's rough.
Or the housekeeping. Yeah, I came back and it was gone. I was like, you idiot. What are you doing? But I was still in the time where I was like, I liked watches, but it wasn't like, you know, I was like, oh, cool. That's, you know, I know that's a nice watch. But
yeah.
I wasn't like obsessive about it yet.
Sure.
Yet. That came later.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
But yeah, that was, I had to tell him that and he's like, oh,
come on.
So I didn't want to think about like, God, what was that? It was like a 70s 1680 or something. I don't know. I think it was just a 5513. I don't know. Anyway, I can't think about it. It just disturbs me.
Yeah.
But, so then I have a stylist, Ilaria Urbanati, and she basically, how that works is, you know, if you have press coming out for a movie, TV show, the studio will, you know, they'll give a certain budget to have a stylist dress you for, you know, Jimmy Fallon or doing press junkets and all this. And part of that dressing is, you know, she's awesome. She like puts me in these really great suits that, you know, I don't really get to keep, but I get to wear them for, you know. And I remember her going, do you have any watches? You need a nice watch to wear with this suit. And IWC was one of the companies that she worked with and was like, here, you know, this will look really nice with that. And I was like, funny, this is like the only other nice watch I have is an IWC. It was given as a gift. And and then that's when I started going, oh, wow. Cause this has got to go back. This is like,
Now you know how we feel all the time, right? We get to see these amazing things, but they always have to go back.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you do, don't you? You get to hold them and wear them and then they go back. Yeah.
Great stuff that gets sent back.
But she dressed me for the Met Ball a couple of years ago. And this is when, at 4 or 5 years ago. So that was probably when I started with IWC. And I was wearing a really nice, I think it was a perpetual calendar. And I was like, what is this thing? And what do you mean it will keep time until 2499? And Kurt Klaus, who developed this, I started wondering, why is this special, and learning about it. I did a couple of, press things where IWC were kind enough to like give me a watch to wear for the thing. And then they invited me to SAHH 1 year. And I flew out and got to see all the new goodies. And that's when I was speaking to, at the time it was George, but everybody there on board the creative team and I had done my homework, and they were like, yeah, well, you know your stuff. that feels good.
Yeah.
We want people that, to be aligned with this brand, that care about it and understand why this is special.
That I wore like all through my 20s that Joe had on.
Every real watch nerd knows that they're looking at wrists when they watch movies and TV. Director Rian Johnson is no different.
What's really funny is because I've only really gotten in any knowledgeable way into watches like in the past, like, 10 years or so. And so the Star Wars, you can't really place watches.
It's a little hard, yeah.
So, although it's tempting, it'd be pretty cool if just Han Solo was like rocking a Patek or something. But before that, Looper, I mean, there's a pocket watch that he has during it. I thought about like looking at a specific brand of it, but ended up just going with, my prop guy found like a really interesting style with a really particular face, and I was just stylistically that looks good, and it's generic enough to where it's not going to take anyone out of the story. So
yeah,
and it's set in this weird future, so you don't want to date it using like it. So right. I don't know, but I do sometimes. I found myself watching movies that I love and just kind of squinting and saying, oh, what's
oh, for
he
sure.
Movie watch.
Yeah, probably. Movies, yeah. TV, shows I don't even care about.
Yeah.
James just watches somebody TV else's watching just for the TV watches.
And I'm like, oh, look at that.
Have you guys ever tracked down a watch that you found, like...
Like hunted to find out what it actually
yeah,
was?
Yeah.
Oh, probably, yeah. Like, I mean, the big one is Cooper in Jaws.
What is he wearing?
It's an Alestra. They're actually doing a reissue of it. It just came out. It's like a skin diver, but on like a metal band style bracelet that has like big rivet holes in it.
That's awesome.
Oh, dude.
Yeah.
Have you ever tracked anything?
I've done it twice. I have to stop myself from doing it more because it could just be a rabbit hole. But I did.
That could be an interesting vein of collecting, though. Like you collect watches you've seen
in
movies.
I'm very shocked that actually there's not kind of a whole subset of the culture that's it. Maybe there is, and I just don't know it. But
yeah.
After Hours, you know the Scorsese movie?
After, yeah.
Yeah. So because there's so many close-ups of Griffin Dunne's watch during the course of the night as his universe is falling apart, and every time it flashed to it, I was like, what is that watch? And it's actually... It's a Hamilton khaki branded, like the military style watch. And
okay.
This was before you guys did like the piece on it and with the reissue that just came out.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's
the one that our producer Gray is wearing over here on the other side of the studio.
There you go. That's it. Yeah. Yeah. There it is. So this is before this came out. And I was like, oh my God, that's such a cool. And so I just went on eBay. And it was just, it was very cheap. I was able to find one.
Yeah.
Like one of those, the symbol, like the Songbird ones.
Yeah. Exactly. It's like this. It's much smaller than this. And it's got the khaki brand
that's cool.
on it. But yeah. Oh, that's really nice. Oh, sure. And then the other one. There's this movie, The Other Side of the Wind. Have you heard about this?
Oh, this is the Orson Welles thing, right?
Okay. So... I've gotten to know, sorry, we're going to be talking for an hour before we even really start.
This is awesome.
Okay,
this is perfect.
All right. So I've been lucky to get to know Frank Marshall, the producer, who's Kathy Kennedy's husband. You know, Kathy runs Lucasfilm, so I've worked with her really closely with Star Wars. And Frank is a legend, and he's also kind of, he's kind of the Forrest Gump of the film world, not in terms of his intellect, but in terms of every time you start talking to him, he'll bust out another story of, oh yeah, I was hanging out with these guys while they were doing this amazing historic thing. It's just absurd. One of the things that he did was he worked in like the 70s with Orson Welles when Welles was making like his last couple movies. And he got into that through working with Bogdanovich. He was like Bogdanovich's guy on Paper Moon, Last Picture Show. I mean, he goes back like to the day and like, you know. So anyway, he got into working with Orson Welles on this last movie that Welles shot but never finished called The Other Side of the Wind. And it starred John Huston as this aging film director. And Bogdanovich actually co-stars in it as like his protege, sort of. But anyway, Frank for years was trying to get a hold of the original footage. He finally did it. It was like locked in a vault in Paris with all this complex French bureaucratic bullshit, like keeping everyone's hands off. And he finally found a way to get everyone to agree and sign whatever they had to do. Got the footage, cut it all together into a movie. And I got to see it recently. They're going to premiere it. It's going to be on Netflix, like I think later this year.
Oh, awesome.
It's incredible. Oh, right. And John Huston in that movie, they shot it like in the mid-70s, I think, early 70s. And he's wearing a Pulsar P2. He's wearing
such a weird watch.
Oh, yeah. So strange that John Huston is wearing this, like what would have been at the time, like a cutting edge, like, you know.
It looked like the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it did the 2001 inspired, like, and so I tracked one down. And I got one of those.
It's super cool.
Which it's not actually that, I don't know. I mean, you can find them and they're not astronomical or anything.
Were you able to find one that works?
No. Okay. But so that's the next step is I got to figure out.
Okay.
And it's so dumb, I'll still wear it around even though
why not? Yeah, it's awesome.
But then I went to a YouTube rabbit hole recently, is watching a bunch of Peter Sellers interviews from the early 70s, and I spotted him wearing one as well.
The same thing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Pulsar V2. I was like, wow, all these dudes.
It's like a weird cult watch.
I guess so, yeah.
They're probably all gifted each other then.
I'm sure. It's probably the same watch. Yeah.
They're friends, or one guy gifted all his buddies one and it's filtered through, something like that.
Very possible. Yeah.
So a few years later,
Here, MB&F founder Max Bucer shares how he fell in love with watches in the first place.
Engineering and sociology, and I chose to sort of discover why people would pay these insane amounts of money for something which was antiquated technology. And I sent letters out to the big brands. And in those days, those big brands were so small. I think in those days, like Breguet was doing 600 watches a year and Vacheron 700 watches a year. And that me, a little student from a local university, gets a letter back from the CEOs of each company.
Not bad.
That it's insane when you think of it today. That's the extent of how small that industry had become. Saying, well, young man, if you come at this hour, that day, I'll give you 1 hour. So I met Steve Urquhart at AP, Claude Daniel Prolox at VC, Gerald Genta himself, Henri-John Belmont at Jaeger-LeCoultre, Henri, what's his name, Mr. Baudet at Breguet. And so there I am. I'm going to interview them and like explain to me why.
And how old are you when this is happening?
I'm probably about 20, 21.
Okay.
Yeah. And they all more or less tell me the same thing. We know what we do is pointless, but it's so beautiful. And for me, it was a shock because engineering college in those days, at least in Switzerland, the notion of beauty never, ever was even factored anywhere. Is you have to be efficient. We're Swiss, we're engineers, we have to be efficient. and so this whole sort of beauty, which became something emotional, as I was already amazed. And then they came up with, and you do realize that if we do go down and we don't survive this era, generations of artisans are going to disappear. People who have given from father to son the tricks of how to do a Breguet curve on a spiral and how to angle that that angle, etc., etc. All that knowledge is going to disappear. And that's another world premiere for me. It was somebody talking about humanity. There is no, at least there was no humanity in my engineering studies. And I actually felt completely in love with it. And then I went to do my military service. That's what we do when we're Swiss. And had a absolutely horrible accident. I shouldn't be here. I mean, there is no reason I should be alive after that accident. And after 6 weeks in hospital, and I don't know, like 6 weeks at home in a cast, complete with my whole upper body in a cast. Luckily for me, my left hand, my left arm was free. I actually jumped on a bus and went up to the center of Lausanne, where I used to live. And I had, in my mind, for a year, I'd been seeing that Abel chronograph with the Primero movement in steel. Everybody was buying the golden steel in those days, and it was just all in steel. And I go to the store and I say, I'm completely in my cast. You can imagine the thing. This youngster comes completely in a cast coming in and says, I want that watch. And she gives me the price. And I buy it, and she puts it on my wrist, and I go back in the bus, and I'm screaming in the bus, I got my watch. So that's how I realized I was completely hooked.
You saw that interest you.
Well, look.
The watch industry can sometimes be obsessed with looking backward, but technology legend Tony Fadell is much more excited about looking forward.
I have to hand it to, like, AP. Yeah. With the RD2.
Oh, man.
I salivated. I went crazy over the RD2. When I learned about how it was done and the technology they used to make that slim, calendar watch, and to look at how it was done by the gearing that they've done and the teeth, it was basically a programmable mechanical machine. They created something like an automata from back in the day. That's what they created in there. And I can't believe, when you see it, you go like, duh. But no one in the industry did that. And it was blow away. Yeah. So I was like, yes, baby, I'm in. And it doesn't have an e-crown or anything else, but I'm like, I appreciate that 100%.
I think my
favorite,
I
can't wait to have one.
I think my favorite thing about that watch is that they said they could have made it thinner, that there's actually extra airspace in the case, but they didn't because they thought it would destroy the proportion of the bezel to the case and it would mess up the actual design integrity of the Royal Oak. So instead of getting a record that they could use as marketing material, they actually focused on making the product the right product, which I feel so often gets lost, but they put making a good thing ahead of being able to sell some marketing collateral.
I had never heard that until you just told me, and I love it even more because a watch is about a watch or any design. It's not just about the internals and about going for specs. It's about the whole package, what it looks like, what it feels like, what the technology is inside it, the full representation that there was love and care thought about at every single point of the process. Totally. And to me, when you say it was bigger and there's a little bit more air, damn, okay, cool with me. Great, because it's going to wear differently. It's going to look different. Proportions are, for me, everything.
So what do you think of this? You know, there's this increasing tension between watchmaking as a materials science activity and watchmaking as a traditional craft activity. Mm-hmm. So there's the sort of, you know, novelty versus tradition.
You know, this is, again, this, you know, old world versus new world. You have to embrace, be curious, and have and understand that if you trust the people who are presenting it to you to a certain extent, have a little bit more of an open mind and learn and embrace. Because, you know, everything has to evolve. Yeah, the watch industry has to evolve. And there are lots of incredible technologies that need to be adopted. Now, I'm not saying all of them.
Right,
there's
right.
all kinds of issues with silicon, but they're starting to resolve those. Right? I have a couple based on that. So I think, again, that if we don't continue to move this forward, we're only going to have traditionalists buying them and the market will die.
Right.
And then we're all going to be sitting crying in our drinks going, why can't I get new watches? Because we're not feeding it the things that they need to be able to be economically healthy.
But don't you think there's something comforting? I mean, I'm not defending it, but there's something comforting from an enthusiast perspective about being inflexibly doctrinaire about things.
So that's their choice.
Yeah.
So be it. I have no judgment. That's fine. They should go off and do that. That's great. But industries must evolve to remain healthy, and we're not all going to just buy antique watches, you know, and right. stuff. We need to keep this place. We need to keep this industry healthy. We need new technologies to come in to keep people excited, the ones that are there excited, as well as new ones to come in. If we don't do that, it's going to be a dead end on the chain of evolution of watches.
And the RD2 is a perfect example of that. There's nothing overtly kind of like cutting edge about any of the material science, anything crazy like that. It's
yeah, as far
a new
as I
way
know,
of
that's true.
Thinking,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And any traditionalist, if they see that watch, they have to embrace it. If they can't embrace the RD2, it's like, what? Come on. What? It's just different. And it's a lot better.
Right.
They didn't break all of the tenets of traditionalism in any way, shape, or form. They just did it incredibly smartly. But the way I think about it is that people or companies or industries or countries don't change unless there's a near-death experience. Right? Think about it. You sit there and you eat, drink, whatever it is. You don't exercise all of a sudden. And you're like, the doctor says, hey, you need to get healthy. Yeah, it's never going to happen to me. Then you get that heart attack. And you're like, oh, shit. I'm going to have to clean up my life, right? And some people, they make lifelong changes. Some people, six weeks or six months, they try to change. But any kind of organism usually will not make major changes unless there's a near-death experience. Quartz, smartwatches, and it breathes new life and new direction and makes a stagnant market or person or whatever evolve.
So you think we were primed to maybe enter like a new golden age or a new period of increased creativity because of the kind of like threat, again, in quotes, from smartwatches?
Exactly. When you have more constraints and more competition, it helps to focus and to go, what are we really doing here? And you get the real innovation coming out, right? And saying, okay, we're going to embrace it and we're going to show them we can innovate too. Watch us, right? That's what the human spirit's all about. And so this is only healthy, right? And if they don't want to embrace it, or anybody in the industry doesn't want to embrace it, fine, but you're going to become the dodo bird.
Work like yourself who really make the whole watch beginning to.
And finally, watchmaking legend Philippe Dufour talks about the real value of a handmade watch.
The very first watch that you made for yourself, I think we were just looking at the movement. That's the you made a Grand Sonnerie?
Yeah, Grand Sonnerie Minute-Repeater wristwatch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was...
In 92. Yeah.
And then nobody had ever seen anything like this before.
No. It was a big surprise.
So what made you decide... I mean, this is... even today, if I'm a brand, you know, with a billion-dollar company behind me, this would, computers and CNC, this would be a crazy thing to do, and you did it. You did it by yourself without any of this stuff.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
I mean, of course, the modern technology can help you, but what is important is the component coming out of could be a hand-operated machine or a CNC machine. This component, if you use it the way it is not enough.
Right.
So you have to add something. And this something, you add it by hand.
Right.
It's not, and even the hand gives you, I mean, something probably less accurate than a CNC machine. Because CNC machines are very accurate, but it gives you this hand finish. It's like a painting, you know? If you have a painting made by a robot, okay. But if it's hands doing that, you can feel it.
Right.
And I see the people who are owning my watches. They feel something when they look at the movement. Yes. I give you an example. Something happened to me 2 years ago in Japan. I was there to give a lecture to the school. The third time I go there, it's marvelous to be there because you have 20 students for 1 week, but they kill me, you know. But I mean,
really? How?
Yeah, they want to know. They want to beautiful, you know, and polite and respect.
Yeah,
nothing to say. And as I was there, the shop Shellman, who sold most of the Simplicité in Japan, he told me, while you are here, spend 2 days in the shop. So he invited all his customer. these people, I met them 10 years ago sometime.
Yeah.
They came in the shop, recognized the kids were like that. Now they are big. We make photos. They're wearing the watch, explaining me how they live with their watch. You know, very marvelous moment. And one guy arrived and told me he's the doctor. And he, in his shop, not his shop, his, how do you call that for a doctor?
His office.
He has all pictures of my watches. Mm-hmm. He has all the magazine, because there was a lot of, beginning of the 2000, we had a lot of Japanese magazine who make report from the workshop. So he has everything, and he explains to his patient where the watch is coming from.
Right.
And he told me he has some patient, very sick, cancer, end of life. And he let them wear the Simplicity for a while. And he told me they are happy for a moment.
Yeah.
And he asked me to sign two pictures of his patient, you know. Oh, wow. Wearing the Simplicity, and you have eyes, brilliant eyes. You know? I came back in my workshop. I was sitting on my bench. And I said, it's just marvelous, because I still have a lot of pleasure to finish a watch. Every time, it's like a new baby, you know?
Yeah, but you know, when you make a watch, and you're just thinking about making the watch when you make the watch, but it goes out into the world.
Yeah.
And sometimes it really makes these moments that are important in people's lives.
Exactly. And I said, for me, I'm still a lot of pleasure. Every time a watch is finished. I said, if this watch can give pleasure to somebody around the world, it's just marvelous. Circle is closed, you know?
Yeah.
So the way we usually wrap up Hodinkee Radio is by asking our guest the Hodinkee Questionnaire, a series of five questions. One of those questions is, what's the best piece of advice you've ever received and who gave it to you? Our first 50 guests have given us some pretty incredible answers, and here are some highlights.
It would have to be what I said earlier, which is, you know, our time here is limited. And I've received that from a few really important people.
Fast nickels over slow dimes.
Just try. You know, just give it a shot and try.
It has to be Günter Blümlein. Mr. Büser, creativity is not a democratic process.
Well, I've taken a lot of advice from people, and what I've kind of turned into this idea of being the best part of another person's day.
Just do what you love, baby. Just do what you love. They'll find you. And that's so true.
Nothing in the world will last forever, be it good or bad.
It's one you hear a lot. It would have been my mother, who just encouraged me to listen and not talk, because if you talk, you're not going to learn anything.
Spend a lot of money on either your shoes or your bed, because if you're not in one, you're in the other.
Richard Story, when I got this job, told me that I will notice that people laugh much more loudly at my jokes now, and to remember that I'm really not that funny.
My grandmother on my paternal side, she had this, like, she's from New York, she has this thick accent. People are people! That's how she would say it.
From my dad, no one ever went broke taking a profit.
My mother, she said, as a young child, she said they can take anything in this world away except for what you know.
You know, honestly, for me, it was my mother. When I was very young, she just told me the most important thing to do was what I loved.
It's so simple. Follow your heart.
It's all one life. There's no separation between work and home and fun and pleasure.
Ask for forgiveness, not for permission.
It's never too late to do the right thing.
Mine's pretty simple. Never give up.
Mark Thorpe, you gave me my mantra. Show up, do dope shit.
Perfect. I love that. I'm in.
You just aren't owed anything in this life. So what you get, you either ask for, and I believe very strongly in asking for what you want, and I think the rest of the time you need to process what it is that would, like, maybe make you happy and try and make it happen.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode and all of the episodes we've made over this first year. This show has been a real labor of love, and the feedback we've gotten from all of you has been incredible, truly. We're really excited to see what the next year brings, and along those lines, we'll be back in 2 weeks with something pretty special.